You're listening to God, Law, and Liberty with David Fowler and Gary Humble. We're putting culture on a collision course with the truth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our very first full episode of God, Law, and Liberty. I'm Gary.
And I'm David.
Well, we had our first little oopsie there, and so you got to experience that for the first time. It's all good.
We got it out of the way early.
We got out of the way early because we're going to do that, honestly, a lot more as we proceed with this thing.
This is real and this is live.
Exactly. Hey, so this is exciting to jump into this with you, David. And I think we're going to talk about, you know what? I'm going to let you go ahead and discuss what we're going to talk about. And then I'm going to jump in as you go.
Well, let me just say to our listeners or to our viewers, actually, we're trying to stream this today. Yeah, that's right. So the title of this podcast, as we talked and tried to come up with something, God, Law, and Liberty, those are three very fundamental things. And one of the things that we'll be doing that I think will differentiate this podcast from all other podcasts that I've heard or radio shows you might listen to is that we want to talk about the interrelationship between these three fundamental concepts, God, Law, and Liberty.
Yeah.
But we need to understand them in terms of a historical context. How did these things become important? Why are they important? Then how did those things connect to and shape our form of government the way it was supposed to work? Are we working that government the way it was supposed to be worked based upon the principles that it was founded on, which are drawn from history? And then we want to look at those in the context of specific issues. So this won't be just a theological discussion. It won't be just a political discussion. It won't be just a historical, or it won't be just a current events commentary. I'd love to see us draw all of these things together. In fact, if I ever started a church, I might call it the newspaper church. And right. Every week we preach out of something in the newspaper and talk about it and make it relevant to what we're doing. So that's what I really look forward to doing here.
And so today we're going to sort of dig into, you know, where does authority come from? And it was really fun having this discussion earlier today as we were kind of preparing for this podcast. I'm excited to talk about it. And I'm sitting here looking at Federalist Paper number 10.
I didn't give you number 14, but I'll throw it in where appropriate. But
right. And so how do you want to start this, David? Because kind of what I see we're going to discuss today is the idea that you know, humanity, we form our own tribes. We have all of these divisions. We have this idea of individualism and anonymity, and then we're trying to mix into that. How do we adjust for liberty? Which I think is the difficult question that our framers tried to address here. And so
we did. And I think if I were to say, what's the biggest problem? The biggest problem is a loss of a sense that there's any truth to guide us at all. But apart from that, and related to that really, is the question of authority. We really have a crisis of authority in our country. Now, people may not appreciate what I actually mean by that, but I read something a couple of years ago that said that the problems that are faced in our society and in politics today cannot be addressed because those that are charged with trying to address them, both either the people in a sense through who they vote for or in our elected officials, don't have the philosophical tools by which they can address the question of authority. Now, here's what I mean by that. We have a culture that has taken the concept of liberty to extremes that were never known in the preceding thousands of years of history. It's really an autonomy. And in fact, the United States Supreme Court talks about from Roe up until the Obergefell decision on same-sex marriage in 2015 of individual autonomy. Throughout that, you see individual autonomy, individual. Right. And we would have said, No, we don't have individual autonomy. Even if you want to be godless, we owe duties to our fellow citizens. The world doesn't just revolve around me. We disagree with Pythagoras in the sense that man is the measure of everything because we have to live together. Right. And so the question is, who gets to say what the law should be? Who gets to say what we should or should not do, ought or ought not to do? And every time you say you shouldn't do that or you ought to do that, you're asserting some underlying idea about authority. Because otherwise you'd say, I'd like it if you didn't hit me in the face. But, you know, if you really feel like you need to, that's quite all right. It really makes no difference. The relativist would say, there is no authority. We're our own authorities. And then as soon as you break in line at the movie theater, there's an authority somewhere, right? Right. And they're going to call the guy to make you mm-hmm. go to the back of the line. So we got to address this issue of authority. And where in our country do we find the basis for authority? Is it in the mass of people? We often throw the word democracy around as if we think we're a democracy, and our founders would have said, no, I don't. Where would you get that? How uneducated are you to think we're a democracy? Or is it some elite group that tells us what we should do? Or is it the king? We don't obviously have one. Or is it God? Where is the source of authority by which we have the ability to even have law? Because law is command.
Because if every individual is the authority, which seems to be what we're talking about today, and we kind of ebb and flow from one extreme to the other,
sure.
But at some point, if I'm just living my life autonomously,
right?
At some point, as we collide in life, my autonomy will run over your autonomy.
Yeah.
And then what?
Unless I can run over yours first.
Exactly.
But that's really right. If, you know, that used to be the Greeks talked about atomistic understanding, that we're just all sort of like little individual atoms and we all stay in our lane. But we don't stay in our lane. You know, in fact, you just cut me off in my lane in the traffic, right. And all of a sudden your autonomy to do that interfered with my autonomy to drive as fast as I wanted to do. So we know that's not workable, but we're foolish. We don't really stop and ask these fundamental basic questions, and I think we need to do that.
Yeah.
Because when you get to the questions like abortion and marriage that we're going to be talking about over the course of the next several months,
right.
Really, you've got to decide, where is that authority that says you can or you cannot kill an unborn child? You can or cannot define marriage this way.
Right.
Who has that authority? And I remember reading several years ago a book by Watchman Nee. He was died, I think, in prison in China. He was a missionary. And he said, the question of the universe is who shall have the authority. And that's really true. And from the Christian perspective, we'd say that was the very first question in the garden, wasn't it? Who really has authority here? Did God really say those things? Is he really the authority here? Or can you determine right and wrong and good and evil for yourself and be like God? And so that runs through the course of the whole nature of history, is you have to resolve that question. And what's interesting, one of the things, you and I were talking about beforehand, is there was a brilliant little clip from Ravi Zachariah that I've used sometimes when I've done seminars, where he talks about the fact that when it comes to these questions of authority and sociology in our society, how do we determine truth? How do we determine what the law is, what the ought to be? Who has the authority to say this is the ought? He made a great statement. There are only three choices, and that's it. And the problem is, most of society doesn't like the first choice he gave us.
Right. Let's take a listen.
Take a listen.
It's 3.5 minutes here, but stick really with it. It's really good content.
So let me take, first of all, the sociological issue here. What is the problem now? We talk about tolerance. So when I was at one of the prestigious universities, somebody went to the microphone and asked this question. And I said to the person, I said, I will be glad to answer your question if you will first answer mine. What kind of a culture are we living in? You have to define it for me. I said, as far as I know, there are three cultures in relation to absolute. The first culture is called a theonomous culture, where the law of God is supposedly so embedded into our hearts that we all emotively or otherwise think in the same categories. Once upon a time, we would talk about the natural law in those categories. Natural law, we believe these truths to be self-evident. The early framers believed in the natural law. We don't believe in natural law anymore, but we used to talk about it. And that's a theonomous culture, theos, God, nomos, law. Sometimes the Indian culture will get close to that. It's not always the case, but they sort of, dharti ke aadmi is what they will say. We are people of the soil. And the idea of respect for parents and all of that, they consider to be self-evident, ingrained in the heart of man and so on. But we don't believe in the theonomous culture in the West. So what's the second kind of culture? The second kind of culture is a heteronomous culture. Heteros meaning another, nomos meaning law. So we have another law. What does that mean? The mainstream of the culture is dictated to by the leadership at the top. If you look at Marxism in secular terms, it is a heteronomous culture. The handful in the top will control the masses. If you look at Islam, it's a heteronomous culture. If you go to Saudi Arabia or you go to Iran, which are supposed to be truly Islamic countries, the mullahs or the sheikhs or who are the ayatollahs at the top will tell the masses when they must fast, when they can eat, what they must wear, what they must not wear, who they can be seen with, who they cannot be seen with. All of the dictates, even to the discipline of how you wash your hands and feet before you worship and so on, it's a heteronomous culture. The few at the top dictated for the masses below. So I looked at the question and I said, are we a theonomous culture? He said, no. I said, are we a heteronomous culture? He said, no, we don't want the few to dictate it for the many. I said, so that leaves us with the third, which is an autonomous culture. Autos meaning self, nomos meaning law, which means each person dictates their own moral prerogatives in the sense. I said, are we an autonomous culture? He said, yes. I said, all right, now tell me this. If we are an autonomous culture, and I answer your question, are you going to give me the privilege of my autonomy too? Or as soon as you disagree with my answer, you will switch to a heteronomous mode and dictate for me what I must believe as well. That is the sociological dilemma. That is the sociological dilemma, because if A disagrees with B, it's not just that A is being enforcing his or her principles upon B, but B wants to enforce his or her principles upon A. So there's a mutual autocracy being sought here, but it is never going to be consistent in a culture that is neither theonomous nor heteronomous. Autonomous cultures run into a conflict where everybody has their own autonomy. That's the law. That's the sociological issue.
Well, that's good. You know,
that's a really good clip.
And I hope people understand what when he's talking about the sociological issues and how do we what are the three ways we can address them. That's what I really mean by authority. He's getting at as a society, how do we interact with one another? How do we decide what we should do and what we ought to do? And so when the Supreme Court in the 1992 case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, where they last really reaffirmed Roe, they said that individual autonomy was the source of our dignity and our rights, and so you had the freedom to define your own concept of meaning and the universe and God and all this sort of stuff. And it's kind of like, does the court realize that the root of the word autonomy is law, self-law? And they have to know self-law only works if we're under some other law that we've all agreed to obey.
Right.
It doesn't work. And so I think it's just ironic that this group of people from Ivy League schools who are the top of the top of the top, you know, supposedly to be on the court, don't understand that every time they use the word autonomy,
right,
they are undermining any coherent legal system.
Of course, because everyone cannot rule themselves within their own framework of law.
Yeah, for everybody.
For everybody,
yeah,
right.
I can govern myself at home, maybe.
Yeah, sure.
But I, you know, once I step outside the door, I'm headed towards trouble. So this is the really critical question, and if we can't answer it, then we're in trouble. And you'll notice that he mentioned that we used to have really a theonomous theonomous culture,
right.
Because we had a belief in sort of natural law.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that
our basic understanding of all of these principles were rooted in the same thing.
Yes, that's right. So, talking a little bit of history here, the concept of natural law was that God, as the creator, had imposed a law on nature. It governed plants and animals and all of those things. And when it got to man, man too was governed by a law suitable to his nature. And that he should therefore, as a dependent being created by God, conform in all points to the law of his maker in order to function properly. I've often used in it was actually a lawsuit, and the guy won. He used his lawnmower to trim his hedges and got hurt. And you should know that lawnmowers were not meant to trim the hedges, but he was holding the mower up trying to trim his hedges, and he got hurt, and he sued, and he won. But what the natural law was is that God has created a law of morality and ethics for the governing not just of our physiological bodies, but of our internalness, our relationship to God, our relationship to our neighbor. And it's suitable to who we are, the same as the instincts, let's say, we wouldn't call it ethics, of a dog or a cat or a deer or whatever it is, or plant life or photosynthesis. They're all regulated by law. That was natural law. Now, the problem, if we want to put it in a historical context, and we'll be talking in the future about William Blackstone. He was the last probably great commentator on what was called the common law and the natural law. Actually, in America, it might have been Joseph Story, who was on the United States Supreme Court, but in the early 1800s. But the concept there was that, well, the problem is our reason is not always sufficient to reason to what the natural law would be. And Blackstone said it very well. He said, if our reason were intempered or not affected by sin, by the fall, by our first ancestor, then the talk would be easy and pleasant, he said. We'd have no other need for any guide other than reason, because we were made right. But because of the fall of our first ancestor, he says, we find that our reason is intemperate, and it's ruffled by passions and desires and all kinds of things. And of course, as you were reading Federalist Paper 10, you're hearing all that, right?
Yeah, of course.
You're talking about factions.
So one of the things that Federalist Number 10 really deals with is this idea of faction, that, you know, we desire autonomy, but in our autonomy, it's you can't deny that humans are very much tribal, which means we desire to associate with those who think like us. And as we find those individuals, we form these factions and these groups of people. And, you know, whether we're Saints fans or Dallas Cowboys fans or, God forbid, Tennessee Titans fans, and, you know, or whatever the case may be, or we're Republicans or Democrats or Independents, we identify with like-minded people. And one of the issues that this paper brings up is that, you know, when you will invariably or inevitably have factions. You cannot prevent factions from forming in our humanity, okay?
Sure.
But there's only two methods when factions happen, there's friction is going to happen, which is why we need some sort of a framework of law, right? And there, he says, there's only two ways to get rid of these factions. One is by destroying liberty, which is essential to its existence to begin with, or two, by forcing every citizen to have the same opinions, the same passions, and the same interests, both of which are essentially impossible to do. So then the question then sits, how do we deal with those factions, with the fact that we're going to form different groups with different opinions? How do we deal with that, and how do we retain liberty in the midst of that without destroying it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a tough thing. I think our founders did a great job with it. But, you know, that's what you see over in China now, is they restrict everything so that we can try to make sure everybody has the same opinion.
Homogenize everything.
Yeah,
or,
yeah. So everybody's going to have the same opinion, because all they're going to get is one opinion. That's of the state. And you destroy liberty to go with it. So I have no freedom to go listen to the God, Law, and Liberty podcast. I have to listen to the state broadcast on channel 1, 2, 3, and up to 100. And so liberty creates faction, but faction destroys liberty if you don't figure out how to do it. And here's the other great philosophical question dealing with authority. And it goes back to what we started with. It's the philosophical question that's existed since time immemorial. is the question of the one and the many. How do you have diversity without having chaos and have unity without having totalitarianism? How do you have a balance between liberty and unity, between diversity and unity? Now, as I was saying, Blackstone said, look, here is the problem. Our own experience shows that our reason is not perfect. So you can look at one thing and reason that, well, sure, abortion is healthcare somehow, or marriage should be any combination of people who love each other. And to you, that may be as reasonable as me thinking it should be limited to two people, as somebody thinking marriage should include pets and animals too, you know, okay? If there's not some foundation, at the beginning. So he said, therefore, God in his benevolence and his goodness has been pleased at sundry times, a phrase Christians will remember from Hebrews, where he says sundry times, to give us revelation, to confirm and clear up those precepts that we come to by reason to say, yeah, I must have reasoned right because it's consistent with this. Now he said, the reality is reason will over time show that you were wrong because there are natural consequences to doing wrong things. But that's why God was kind, as he said, rather than let you find out 50 years from now you should have never had no-fault divorce, or 50 years from now you should never allowed killing in the womb, or 50 years from now you should not have redefined marriage, I'm going to give you my revelation by which you can look and say, well, no, this is interesting. There's man and there's woman. Why is there man and woman? Why are there not just men or not just women? And how do we, oh, so I've reasoned to certain things, and I can go to the scripture and say, oh, look, here's what it says. Yeah, we were made for a purpose. And this purpose reveals something that's true about us because it reflects who God is. He's a, according to Christian theology, he's one essence, but three in persons. And so we have unity, we have diversity.
Well, because one of the things that came out of our with authority, one of the issues is if the authority doesn't come from without ourselves, then if it's within ourselves, within which one of us gets to have that authority? And so the issue of fairness, which we love to talk about that word, what's fair today? How is that ever to be fair? Because you're always picking some other faction or some other person that will eventually lord their ideas over you, other than just deciding at the very beginning, look, these definitions in this framework that we all abide by, it comes from outside of all humanity. And so we're all in the same boat at that point. And I love he sort of addresses that here later on in this Federalist paper. He says, a zeal for different opinions concerning religion, concerning government, many other points, as well as speculation of practice, moving on. He says, divided mankind into parties, inflamed them with mutual animosity, and rendered them much more disposed to vex and oppress each other than to cooperate for their common good. So if our authority doesn't lie, you know, in God, somewhere outside of ourselves, then ultimately, if authority lies somewhere within one of our own human factions, at the end of the day, we must understand that in our brokenness, our goal is never going to be for the common good, and it's my good.
That's right.
And it's not always just my good. It's actually I get some good out of destroying you. And my God, how much do we see that going on today? I think about there was a point in time in my life, I was a pastor at a church in North Carolina, and I had never been exposed to this kind of a sports fanatic scenario. If you're familiar with North Carolina, obviously that's where UNC and Duke is, and this is ACC territory, and these people are serious. And UNC, University of North Carolina, and Duke, they're about, I don't know, 15 miles apart. They're not very far. And what I learned very quickly is that, for instance, if you're a Duke fan, you know, if you're part of the Duke faction, the idea is not simply that you root for Duke and you enjoy the successes of Duke. No, you enjoy the complete obliteration and demise of the Tar Heels. That's what it means to be a Duke fan, and vice versa. And so you see that playing out today in all of our different political factions and all the different ideologies that we have. Unfortunately, if the authority lies somewhere within one of those factions, you also have to accept the premise that at some point that faction will attempt to destroy you.
Yeah. Whoever we make God, even if it's me or my tribe, none of us like our authority to be challenged. We don't like rival gods. We would war. So, but that point is so important. If the authority that provides the shoulds and the oughts for us does not exist outside of us, as a law professor once wrote in the Duke Law Journal, he's not a Christian guy, he taught at Yale, he said, then authority must be in us. One of us, a monarchy, some of us, the heteronomous culture or some small group of elite, aristocracy or whatever it might be, or all of us, a democracy. But it can't be anywhere else. It just can't. And so he concludes very sadly that none of those things work. Nobody wants to be under the king's thumb, and whatever he says is the extent of my liberty, and I have no say. As Ravi Zacharias mentioned, as soon as we find out we're not in the heteronomous group, we want to switch to autonomy, and as soon as we switch to autonomy and we find out we're in the minority of the majority, we want to switch to heteronomy, right? And he says, so nothing answers other than the God of the Bible, like the psalmist said, who's like unto our Lord. There isn't anybody like that other than that. But our founders tried to grapple with how do we deal with these factions? How do we deal with the fact that this description you just gave us, that he said, that we find that we're at constant war with one another? How do we deal with what you and I would call our sin nature? That's where we are in this culture. How do we create a government that minimizes that, harnesses the best in us? And they came up, I think, with a great solution. And unfortunately, we don't understand it very well. But as we get near the end of perhaps this broadcast and we go into the next one, there are a couple of thoughts that cross my mind. There, this law professor I mentioned from Yale in the Duke Law Journal, he concluded his analysis of how do we find the objective, unquestioned, authoritative authority in a culture without God. And he gets to the end and he says, well, it looks as if the ruling model is Cain and Abel. And there's no reason to think that it will ever be better. Neither reason nor love nor any of these other things have ever changed us. So therefore, he says, we know that napalming babies is bad and starving the hungry is bad and wicked, and Paul and Hitler and all those are, he says who? God help us. And that's what in Federalist Paper 10 they were saying. The ruling model is Cain and Abel. How do we create a government that deals with the fact that we're Cain and Abel's?
Right. How do we manage that?
And so one of the Federalist Papers said, if men were angels, we'd have no need of government. But because they're not, we need government. So how do you get government to control the heathens, and how do you get the heathens to control the government? And that's what they dealt with, and that's what I want us to explore more. But that's the context. And then I gave you another little quote. Maybe this would be a good place to end because it would lead into talking about how our founders tried to address these things. But de Tocqueville said something very fascinating in his Democracy in America, which was based on his tour of America in 1831, I think it was. He wrote his book and published it in 1934. I don't know if you have it handy, but he makes an astute observation, and I think it would be good to close with that. If the lights that guide us, maybe you don't have it here.
Here. You keep talking, and I'm going to go grab it.
Oh, okay. De Tocqueville was actually a sociologist and a philosopher, and he came to study, I think, the prison system here and wound up being so captivated by our, quote, democracy, that he wrote the book Democracy in America. Of course, we're not a democracy. He should have put republic in America. But de Tocqueville said this: if the lights that guide us ever go out, they will fade little by little. It's the reverse of the frog in the pot analogy we often hear about. As if of their own accord, confining ourselves to practice, we may lose sight of basic principles. And when they've been entirely forgotten, we may apply the methods derived from them badly. We might be left without the capacity to even invent new methods. We'll be so utterly lost, we We won't know how to create something new or different. We will have lost all touch of history and how things came to be where they are, and we just have to start all over like in the Dark Ages. And we're only left to make a clumsy and unintelligent use of wise procedures no longer understood. And that's exactly what's taking place right now, particularly with respect to this notion that we are a government of and by and for the people and representative government. We do not have representative government anymore. Right. What we have is an autonomous culture where the Supreme Court decides the limits and the scope of autonomy and serves the place of God. That's where they are.
And serves the group who at that particular point in time is screaming the loudest.
That's right.
Yeah, we appease the masses. Instead of following the rule of law.
They're the heteronomist, we might say. Right. They're the small group. When they issued the decision on same-sex marriage, and gosh, we could just go for hours probably here, but the very first sentence says, the Constitution promises liberty to all within their reach, within a certain limit within the law, to express and define their identity. And it's talking about our autonomy. I can decide who and what I am, that bodies don't matter. Where I am in society doesn't matter. Where I fit anywhere, it doesn't matter. It's all about me, 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 me. And when they say that within the limits of the law, what they're saying is within the limits of the law that we allow to you. So see, they have become that heteronomous body. We no longer can represent ourselves by saying, no, actually, if you have certain anatomical parts, you should not be in that shower with people with different anatomical parts. Autonomy has exalted itself over the majority. We can't even govern ourselves anymore. And the Supreme Court will decide, no, that person can go in there and take a shower with you. No, they can't take a shower with you. Well, they can take a shower with you in this instance. Well, they can do this in this sport with this instance. And you see what's happened? We've got this heteronomous body that's making the transcendent law for all of us, giving us the illusion we have autonomy when we don't really even have autonomy either.
Right.
They use the word, but they say we decide how much autonomy you have.
Yeah, when you're in a shower together,
yeah,
not a whole lot of autonomy going on there.
Well, I would hope there's some degree.
certainly there is some.
At least when I was playing football in high school, there was a measure of autonomy.
There is. I'm simply saying.
Yes, I agree.
You're not to your own.
Yeah.
Your own self.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, there are rules.
Maybe this would be a good place to start another episode.
So it'll be exciting next to really start talking about, you know, how do we manage liberty then through all of these factions and our desire for autonomy?
Yeah. How do we handle those? What did our founders do? And we'll keep weaving in situations from our courts and our laws and all that. And I hope people will find that fascinating, and we'll bring in some of the history too.
It'd be great. Well, thanks for joining us today and listen to these final messages.
If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe. And if you want to help spread the word, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe too. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts. God, Law, and Liberty is a podcast of the Family Action Council of Tennessee. We are a 100% supporter-funded nonprofit advocating for family, life, marriage, and religious liberty. For more information, please visit us at www.factennessee.org. That's FACTennessee.org. And please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at FACTennessee.